This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our guest Craig Murray brings us up to date on the fate of Julian Assange and the U.S. government's efforts to silence Julian, and with it, investigative journalism and freedom of the press in America. We'll also speak with Diane Feeley, former UAW union member in Detroit, Michigan, to give us her perspective on the UAW strike and on the increasing militancy of the labor movement in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. Julian Assange is the greatest journalist of our time. As a result of publishing the truth about secret government surveillance of American citizens and American war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, the American government and the CIA have plotted to kidnap him and even kill him. They initially smeared his name falsely, accusing him of being a rapist, forcing him to get political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where they videotaped conversations with his lawyers and stole the contents of their phones and computers. At his extradition hearing in London, where the British government did the bidding of the U.S., they kept him incommunicado in a glass box during the hearing, and the judge made her decisions before she had even heard any evidence. They have had him imprisoned in torturous solitary confinement in the notorious Belmarsh prison in London for 4 years. And he could be extradited to the United States any minute now to stand trial on the false accusation of espionage, to which he answers, journalism is simply not a crime. He will certainly, though, be convicted and imprisoned in the right-wing court in which he will be tried in Virginia, and he's facing 175 years in prison. The rule of law is crashing in our country. What is being done to Julian Assange is being done in the name of the law. Well, our guest has written perhaps the most penetrating and eloquent accounts of Julian Assange's predicament. Craig Murray was the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was fired for blowing the whistle on his own country's practice of torture. He himself has recently served 4 months of solitary confinement in prison, where he was put because, he believes, simply to prevent him from testifying at the trial of David Morales, whose company contracted with the CIA to spy on Julian and his attorneys. This alone, had it been able to come into court, could have caused the case of Julian to be dismissed. Well, Craig Murray, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, let's start this way. Let our audience know, in some cases remind them, what's at stake in the Julian Assange case? Why are you, for example, so passionately committed to, well, working in his defense?
Well, I think what we're fighting for is the very principle of free speech and freedom of the press, freedom of journalism, and if you like, in the States, the First Amendment. We have this quite extraordinary situation where a publisher has published information which is acknowledged to be true information. Nobody has claimed any of it is false or misleading in any way. And yet they're being charged with espionage for the act of publishing the information, and not only for the act of publishing the information, for the act of possessing the information. Now, if that were true, it would mean that any journalist who receives leaked information from a source who wants to blow the whistle on something in the national security arena would be guilty of espionage for getting that information from the source. It would absolutely kill the chance of any further revelation to the public of concerns about what their government is doing. And this is a fundamentally new thing. There is no precedent for a publisher being charged with espionage. The idea, of course, that the whistleblower is committing espionage is also, frankly, far-fetched. The use of the Espionage Act, which was brought in World War I against whistleblowers, was initiated first by the Obama administration, and that in itself is dubious. You may be guilty of revealing official secrets, but that's not espionage. Espionage is spying for a foreign power. But the idea that the publisher who receives those secrets is guilty of espionage is such a stretch. It astonishes me that it's being seriously considered.
Yeah, and uniquely so, and sadly so, I would argue with you. You've also written, Craig, that there's never really been any government so evil and repugnant that it was nevertheless not able to find lawyers or particularly judges to do its bidding. And I wonder what illegalities has the U.S. and Great Britain been perpetuating in order to, well, shut up Julian Assange and WikiLeaks?
The problem is, of course, that even the worst dictatorships always manage to find lawyers who are genuine qualified lawyers to say that the illegalities they are carrying out are legal. An example I gave, of course, was the famous Nuremberg trials, where the fact was that the entire persecution of Jewish people and other minorities under the Nazis was so-called legal under the laws passed by the Nazis and was enforced by courts and by judges. That didn't remove the moral responsibility from them for those acts. And enforcing bad laws is no excuse for lawyers to do evil things. In this case, of course, the United States government has won a whole series of legal judgments in the UK on the extradition of Julian Assange. But those legal judgments are making legal acts which would always have been deemed illegal in the past. And simply to give one example, the United States has admitted in court that the CIA organized the spying and videotaping of legal consultation between Julian Assange and his defense counsel, covered by attorney-client privilege. There's no court in the democratic world in which if the prosecution has spied on the defense, and spied in particular on the defense lawyers, that would not have the prosecution thrown out. Yet that has been judged legal in this case. And yet, all the lawyers involved know that is wrong. The judges know it is wrong. But they put aside any concern for the genuine rule of law in order to deliver the verdict that the executive wants. And that is appalling behavior. That is immorality and venality by the lawyers and the judges.
Yeah, and we're going to talk more about that. I'm glad you mentioned that when we talk about the actual extradition trial that took place, of course. And I want to bring us up to that, though. Give us some background before that, if we could. So please talk to us about what has been done to Julian, well, over a span of 13 years at least now, since 2010, when he released the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs proving that the American government committed war crimes. And please talk to us as well about what is known as the Vault 7, which Julian released, proving the extent of American intelligence's all-pervasive surveillance, including bugging our own cell phones and computers right here in this country. So please start by telling our listeners, though, about the CIA's plan then to kidnap and even kill Julian before he finally found himself in this extradition trial.
To take the first one, of course, the immediate reaction to Julian Assange's and WikiLeaks' release of the absolutely shocking material on the conduct of the Iraq and Afghan wars, including, of course, the collateral murder videos showing the killing in cold blood of Reuters journalists. That, the immediate reaction of that was, as so often with enemies of the state, to dig up or invent sexual allegations against Julian. And that was done in Sweden at that time. If you look into the detail of those allegations, they are ludicrous in their nature. And we always said that this is purely a slur to damage his name and an excuse to get him into custody so that he can be extradited to the United States for releasing the Iraq and Afghan information. And that has proven to be true, of course, because as soon as he was actually taken from the Ecuadorian embassy eventually, and as soon as he was got into custody, immediately these Swedish allegations disappeared, as it was admitted there was no evidence to be able to prosecute, and instead they immediately moved to extradite him to the United States for the Chelsea Manning revelations, and which is exactly what we said would always happen. So the whole sexual allegations thing was a charade. It was simply a ploy. And we now have this picture where a journalist, a man of peace, a man who'd always advocated peace, a man who's published nothing but the truth, has been locked in a maximum security prison for over 4 years in appalling conditions, kept with, you know, this is the jail in which the worst terrorists in the UK are housed, and where serial killers are housed. And he is treated in that kind of way. He's treated as though he were a terrorist, a man who has never harmed anyone in his life. This is astonishing. This is an attempt to destroy him physically, and it has caused a severe physical and mental health degeneration.
Yes, and we even know, in fact, because of released documents, then, you know, a CIA director and President Trump, then President Trump, were determined and talked openly about having him murdered, having him killed. And then after that, of course, he is, though, as you alluded to, granted political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. But after time there, the government changed in Ecuador, and so the U.S., and Great Britain, did they not worked with the USA and have had him extradited, out of there and to stand trial? It took him out. They had him standing trial, and you attended that trial. This is a trial to see whether or not he would be sent back to the United States or not. And there have been a lot of commentaries written about that trial, whether it measures up to due process. You attended some of those hearings. What was your own impression of whether or not the extradition hearing itself of Julian Assange met this, well, the world standards of due process and such?
No, it certainly did not meet the standards of due process. Firstly, it was held almost entirely behind closed doors. There were, at times, the public gallery was limited to two or five people. NGOs like Amnesty International and Reporters Without Borders were forbidden to enter. It wasn't the most open of processes at times. Also, the very extradition treaty under which Julian is set to be extradited, the UK-US extradition treaty, at Article 4 specifically states there shall be no political extradition. And the court ruled that treaty has no standing in British law because it's not been specifically incorporated by the British legislature into British legislation. But on the other hand, it is the treaty under which he's being extradited. So how can it at the same time have no standing in law and be the instrument of his legal extradition? You know, these are crazy arguments. Absolutely Alice in Wonderland stuff. And there have been times in the hearings where there have been motions on procedure brought forward by defense or prosecution. One example I might give is that the judge ruled that no allegation may be used that the CIA practiced torture in black sites, because that has not been proven, so it may not be stated in court. Now, one of the witnesses in Julian's favor was a Mr. El Masri, who was kidnapped off the street and taken to a CIA black site where he was held for 4 months. And there he was tortured every day, including mutilation of his genitals. Appalling torture. And eventually he was released back to Germany because the CIA confessed that he'd been taken as a case of mistaken identity. Now, he actually won a case in the European Court of Human Rights against the United States, against the CIA, on the grounds that he had been tortured. So the European Court of Human Rights had determined he had been tortured. And he gave evidence because it was information in diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks that allowed him to win that case, because WikiLeaks released American internal documents admitting that they had done this to him. That's how he won his case. Now, in giving evidence, the judge ruled he was not allowed to say he had been tortured. Now, this is absolutely crazy. You know, this is absolute Alice in Wonderland madness. A man who won his case in the European Court, who there are documents where it's admitted he was tortured, is not allowed to say he'd been tortured. Now, there was a procedural motion brought on this where the defense said he should be allowed to say he'd been tortured, and the counsel of the United States said he should not be allowed. They made their arguments, but the judge had brought in her decision on the procedural motion before hearing the arguments. So I was in the public gallery, which is situated above, higher than the judge's, literally a gallery in that court, and I could see that she had the decision pre-written before hearing the arguments at all. And that wasn't the only time that happened. So what we were seeing was a theater, a farce, a pretense of judicial process, where the actual decisions were not taken in that courtroom. And I strongly suspect that it wasn't the judge herself who had pre-written that decision. She had been given that as the decision that you must not allow United States involvement in torture to be mentioned in the case.
My goodness. Well, this, I am Jim Lafferty, and I'm talking at the moment with our guest, Craig Murray. I would normally be doing this along with my co-host, Michael Smith, who's having some technical issues today and hasn't been able to join us yet, may be able to join us later in the show. Moving right on then, talking of odd positions, the American government has also taken the position that Julian Assange is a non-citizen, which of course he is, but they've said, and therefore he has no First Amendment rights. But in the next breath, they've said, but at the same time, U.S. claims that they have the right to prosecute Julian Assange as a non-citizen in an American court. Does this not strike you as a rather scary universal jurisdiction grab that is, well, frankly, not even rational?
It's not rational at all. He's a non-citizen, and he was not in the United States at the time he published the information. And yet they claim they have jurisdiction over him for something done outside the USA by a non-US citizen. But at the same time, he has none of the rights. So he has all the obligations of following US law, even though he's not American and not in America, but he has none of the rights that you get with US law. This, again, is totally crazy reasoning. And the fact that lawyers are willing even to put it forward, again, you know, shows really ought to be a matter of disgust and disgrace that the legal profession should be deeply ashamed of as a whole. But also, there's another argument on this. You can say, okay, he's an Australian citizen, therefore he doesn't have any First Amendment right of freedom of speech. But if that were true, you must also bear in mind that freedom of speech is also the ability of freedom to hear. I can't know what you're saying unless you're allowed to speak. And what they're seeking to do is deprive US citizens, deprive the entire American public of the ability to hear the truths about their government, which WikiLeaks put forward. So you can't dismiss this as, oh, well, they're merely affecting the rights of an Australian citizen. It doesn't impact on US citizens. It's an attack on the right of US citizens to know what the US government is doing. That's what it is.
Craig, at the end of this extradition hearing, there was one finding in his favor in the initial go-around, having to do with the fact that the kind of prison he'd be put in and what have you back in the United States. The United States appealed that. They won on appeal. It's been back and forth. It's a complicated story to tell procedurally. But at the moment, Julian Assange is pretty much running out of appeals, isn't he? Let our audience know kind of where that stands and what his current appeal is, and whether or not this thing is going to go on much longer before a decision is made whether to extradite him back to the United States, where he would face trial in a very conservative judicial district at a court in Virginia, facing 175 years in prison. Let us know where that stands, though.
Julian submitted his appeal against extradition, which was a 150-page appeal. It was based on freedom of speech grounds. It was based on the fact that political extradition is banned by the treaty. It was based on the fact that the main witness against him is an Icelandic gentleman who's been convicted of paedophilia and fraud, and who admitted that he only gave his evidence for money. And it's been based on the fact that the government, which is prosecuting Julian, spied on his legal counsel and planned both to kidnap and to murder. So, you know, these are quite strong grounds of appeal. But they were dismissed by the appeal court, by the High Court judge, Judge Swift. They were dismissed in just 3 pages of A4, saying that there were no reasonable grounds of appeal. Julian has a single appeal left against that decision, an appeal for a further right to appeal. But that has to be limited to 20 pages of A4, which has now been submitted, and will be limited to a 30-minute hearing. And that's 30 minutes for the whole hearing, not just for the defense. So we seem to be entering now a stage of summary procedure where the judges are very keen to wrap this up and order extradition. After that, Julian may try to appeal to the European Court of Human Rights, but there's a danger an extradition could be organized and expedited before such an appeal can take effect. So we really are getting towards the end game of this. Yes, if one thing as a non-American citizen I find very peculiar is that the government of the United States can choose a kind of hand-picked district with an extremely high population, either employed directly by or dependent upon the security services, in a very conservative, very wealthy town, in order to hold the trial so they will get the jury pool they want to secure a conviction. And that again seems a remarkable piece of legal shenanigans. He would be extradited, and the trial would take place in the court in Alexandria, Virginia.
Yes. And speaking of that court in Alexandria, Virginia, recently, well, you've been on a speaking tour and you recently concluded that speaking tour in the U.S. But last week, when you were in Washington, you ventured out to the courthouse in the Eastern District of Virginia, where Julian, as you say, would be tried and imprisoned. What happened? Tell us about that. Is it not another chapter in this rather bizarre and non-due process, a ridden process?
Yes, I simply went to have a look in the courthouse because I wanted to get a feel for what it's like. I wanted to see what facilities there are for the public gallery and for the media. And I particularly wanted to be able to tell Julian's wife, Stella, what it's like, whether there'd be, you know, preferential access for her as a family member, where she'd be able to sit. Just give her some idea of it. So I went to enter the courtroom during normal working hours, and they wouldn't let me in, which was quite strange. And I said to them, well, surely it's a courthouse, so there must be public access. And they said, yes, but you're not the public. And I said, but you have trials in progress. Unless they're closed trials, there's a legal right to observe trials. And they said, basically, no, Ambassador Murray, we don't want you walking around the building. Please apply in writing to the clerk of the court. Now, the interesting thing is they knew who I was because I hadn't shown them any documentation that had the title ambassador on it. They wouldn't let me into a public building that's supposed to have a public right of access. And B, they had advanced information about who I was, which could be facial recognition technology. It could simply be I was under surveillance. It could be they have a list of people not to be allowed in. But it doesn't give an awful lot of confidence in the openness of the eventual trial, should a trial occur in that courthouse.
No, and that leads me to, well, one of our last questions, I suspect. If Julian does lose his final appeal, he is sent back to the United States, the trial does take place there. What should the American people do? What would you hope they would do and urge them to do?
Well, I think if people have any desire to hang on to the First Amendment, hang on to freedom of the media and to freedom of speech, they have to get out on the streets. They have to do it immediately. They need to contact their democratically elected representatives and explain their concerns to them. And on the day of any extradition, they need to get out there and make sure that media, and that could just be the local media in your local town, have alternative images and an alternative story, and not just the national security nonsense story that will be being pumped over the airwaves. So it's really going to need an expression of popular outrage, and I think it's very important to start planning for that now in case it happens.
Yes. And there is, of course, a National Defense Committee of the United States now, defendjulian.org, defendassange.org. You'll find it. Go on to that website. There are any number of petition drives going on, other actions taking place that our listeners could participate in if they care to. And I would certainly second what you've recommended, Craig. Before we do let you go, Craigberry, how can our listeners follow your work? Where can they find your work, which is extensive?
Yeah, but people are very welcome to come to my website, craigmurray.org.uk. It's craigmurray.org.uk, where people find I write on quite a large variety of subjects. I haven't written much this last 2 weeks. I've been too busy touring the United States. But you'll also be able to find there the full 150 pages of Julian's appeal. It's the only place you can find it. And also work on the other human rights and issues, and you might be interested, I spend most of my time campaigning for Scottish independence, you'll find that on there too.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you, Craigberry. Thank you so much for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and gone? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roam those leaves. Life can be so unkind. I will be found on the edge of the world, where there'll be no one around. Oh, solid ground.
It's no secret that the size and strength of the union movement is not today what it, well, has been in some times past. Where once more than 30% of the U.S. private workforce was unionized, today it's only about 5 or 6%, with another 33% of workers in unionized government jobs, of course. Harsh pro-employer labor laws are a big reason for the decline in unionized jobs, as is the change in the percentage of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. But in the last few years, despite these harsh laws governing union organizing, we've witnessed a surge in militant and successful strikes by workers, nurses, school teachers, more recently the UPS workers, and now the strike by the United Auto Workers. Today we're going to examine that UAW strike, the new way it is being conducted, and to learn what it can tell us about this increased union militancy, why it's happening now, and well, what it may portend for the future. And our guest for this topic could not be a better person to help us understand the UAW strike and the increased militancy of workers and union actions across the United States in general. She is Diane Feely, a 60s radical who started off working with the Catholic worker movement in New York City. Ms. Feely is herself a retired auto worker and a former member of the UAW Local 22 in Detroit, Michigan. She is currently a leader in the socialist feminist organization Solidarity, and she writes regularly for both the Jacobin magazine and the magazine Against the Current. Diane Feeley, a warm, warm welcome to Law & Disorder Radio.
Thanks very much.
Well, Diane, in the earlier days of the labor movement in this country, the UAW and other unions, for that matter, went through periods of some militancy. I'm thinking of the 30s, you know, the UAW had those sit-down strikes in 36 and 37. During some intervening periods of time, perhaps not quite so militant, but again now the UAW seems to have gotten back some of its militancy. Its new president, Sean Fain, is certainly a militant labor leader. Indeed, I think an appropriate quote of his to show that is in connection with the current strike, where he said, and I quote, "I know we are on the right side in this battle. It's a battle of the working class against the rich. The haves versus the have-nots, the billionaire class against everybody else," close quote. However, in an article in this week's New York Times by Noam Schreiber, the claim is made that unnamed so-called experts in that article on unions and the industry have said that the UAW strike might well accelerate a wave of worker actions, or it could stifle recent momentum in the labor movement. What are your own thoughts on that matter?
Yes, I think it's true that a lot is dependent upon our strike and the contract, which is a difficult strike because what we're trying to do is reverse 40 years of concessions. And if we win a decent contract, it will lead immediately to rising expectations among workers, and also to our need to go out and to be organizing the non-union auto parts plants, the assembly plants, and the new battery plants. So I definitely hope that it is accelerating the situation. We need to reverse and move ahead from the tremendous concessions that we've taken.
Yes, and well, the new president, certainly, Diane, of the UAW, Sean Fain, is demonstrating what you're talking about. He was elected by the membership, and that differs from some past practices, doesn't it? And also, there's much more transparency in the bargaining process under its new leadership. For example, in how the members are kept aware of negotiations as they're taking place, and the role of the members themselves in accepting or rejecting the offers coming from the car companies. Talk to us about this, what might call more membership participation, more democracy within the union.
Yes, that's a huge subject. So if I could just start by mentioning that there has been a caucus that has been in control of the UAW and its leadership since 1947. So it's quite entrenched, and it does exist everywhere. So over the years, there have always been challenges to that through opposition, various opposition currents, probably the most well-known of which was New Directions in the 80s and early 90s. But most recently, Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD, came into existence around really the fundamental question of changing the Constitution so instead of electing our top officers through delegates at a convention, it would be one member, one vote. And we were in the process of trying to get that referendum ready for the convention when, in fact, the U.S. government discovered tremendous corruption within that top leadership. I think as of now, 17 members of the UAW in top offices have been sent to jail for their corruption. This corruption was just incredible. We never believed, even people who'd been in the opposition, never believed that they were actually taking money from the corporations and taking money from our funds. We didn't believe there was enough democracy, and we certainly were opposed to the concessions. But the level of corruption was really shocking. And so when the federal mediator came in and was agreed to by the UAW leadership, we were able to get a referendum on the ballot that was sent to every UAW member, both active and retirees, of whether we should keep the delegated system or move to one member, one vote. We won that vote, and I could go into all of the details, but I won't. We then moved to elect the new membership, the new higher officers, which are 14 officers, and we were only able to have candidates for half of those. And frankly, we in UAWD didn't really think we were going to even win one of those offices. In fact, we won all seven, and I think that's because people were so shocked at the level of corruption. So now we're going into the contract, and we've got to show very concretely that we are different from the past practice. And we did that from almost the first day of the negotiations, where instead of shaking the hands of the CEOs, President Sean Fain came to three different locals and shook our hands. And so from that very beginning moment, people could see we were going to conduct things differently. And in terms of transparency, this has always been one of the big problems, that during the negotiations, we were never informed of what was going on. And in fact, the press department, the communications department of the UAW, when they were asked, would just say, no comment. So we weren't allowed to know anything. And so the transparency this time is really very important, because what it's done is it's really inspired workers and retirees to feel that we are involved and to get out there and to organize for the strike preparation, which we did through adopting some of the ideas that the Teamsters for a Democratic Union have used, including practice pickets and wearing red shirts on Wednesdays and organizing 10-minute meetings of co-workers.
Well, you know, I'm an old Detroit boy. I spent the first half of my life in Detroit and was very much interested in what the UAW would do from time to time. And I remember I was always kind of struck and wondered why they would pick one car company to strike and leaving the others alone at first and so forth. And now for the first time, though, in terms of this new approach, for the first time, the UAW is, of course, conducting strike actions against all three of the major U.S. car manufacturers at the same time, which makes sense to me. And it's targeting different locations, of course, different plants of the car makers as the strike progresses. What's the reason behind this this strategy, and what is your opinion of it, Diane?
The demands that we have are very deep. They go far beyond a wage hike, which is what most of the media talks about. They go to structural changes that have to be made. And our most important demand is to end two-tier, or multi-tier, because there's more than two tiers in the plant. So they've been allowed to hire temps, temporary workers, and keep them on as temporary workers for years and years and years. But even when you become a permanent worker, you then have to go through a series of steps, and it takes you 8 years to get to the highest pay, and even then you don't have equal benefits. So this strike is really a very important one in reversing concessions, and the companies are willing to throw a little bit of money at us, but they don't want to make those structural changes. They're very happy raking in the billions of dollars. And so we realize that we have to escalate this strike and not begin at the top. And so we've taken out three plants now, and they weren't the most strategic. They were pretty important plants, mid-size trucks. But we've got a lot more in our arsenal. And Friday noon, there will be, if there aren't adequate and serious negotiations at all of the big three, we will proceed to take more people out on strike. So it's an escalating strategy, which gives us the greatest flexibility and provides, I think, our negotiators with a lot more power as we escalate.
This is Jim Lafferty, and I'm talking with Diane Feeley, former UAW member, a longtime labor activist in Detroit and around the country, now writes about the labor movement a lot and other progressive causes. We're talking about the UAW strike, as I say, and Diane, of course, you've already hit on them in brief form. There's the demand for big wage hike and the two-tiered system, get rid of that. You've talked a bit about that. Give us a sense of some of these other issues that we haven't perhaps gotten as much attention to. I'm thinking, for example, of, is electric cars, what that might do to the number of workers required, because electric cars can be assembled with fewer workers, as I understand it. So talk to us a bit more about that and the pensions and why now, after these years and the concessions you mentioned, it's fair to get that back. Because of the disparities in earnings versus profits of the corporations and such?
You always ask such big questions, but the first thing I want to say is I'm not a former UAW member, because UAW retirees play a very big role in the union, unlike in many other cases where when you retire, that's it. You're no longer a part of the union. Retirees play a very big role in our union, and in fact vote on various officers at the local and national level. So I voted for President Fain as a retired UAW member, which I have the right to do. So retirees play a very big role, and hopefully we're playing that role on the picket line as I speak. So in fact, one of the demands is about retirees. It's not perhaps the largest demand, but in fact, retirees can only get an increase in their pension through the contract that's being negotiated now. And in fact, Big Three UAW retirees have not had an increase in pension since the bankruptcy, possible bankruptcy. So that's like 15 years ago. So that's certainly one of the 10 demands. Another very important demand is cost of living adjustment, because one of the important ways that the wages of UAW members is increased is through COLA, through this cost of living adjustment, which is then folded into your wage. So that's the way it increases in a step-by-step way. And of course, that was done away with the bailout. And I will say that some reporters talk about what the UAW gave back because of the bailout. And I want to make it clear that that's what the leadership agreed to. But what did the UAW members do to deserve those cuts and those concessions? We were not involved in the decision-making of the Big Three, and yet we were penalized as if we were involved. So that's something that we've always opposed. And in fact, concessions have only been agreed to because the leadership falsely said that was the way we were going to keep jobs. That was the only way. And in fact, as Sean Fain has pointed out, 65 plants have been subsequently closed. At the same time, many workers are dealing with overtime. And I remember when I worked at Ford, I worked a 10-hour day, 5 days a week, and every other weekend, another 8 hours. And when they closed a nearby plant, one of my points is, why don't we cut the overtime, and therefore we would have more workers being able to earn a decent living. And I think that's the point, that some people are working 70 or 80 hours a week, not able to see their families, enjoy life outside of work, and yet they do this in order to keep the number of people working at a very low wage.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the politics overlaying this as well, Diane. President Biden, a Democrat, candidate for re-election in 2024, he's come out in general support of the auto workers' demands here. However, the UAW has declined to endorse Biden yet. And they've declined also to his offer to have people from his administration get involved with the strike itself. In addition to that, there is also among Biden supporters a certain fear that the UAW will win, at the very least, significant increases in wages and the like, and that the result will therefore be higher sticker prices on cars that consumers purchase, and that the result of that will be an increase in the level of inflation, and all of that will hurt Biden votes. What is your thoughts on that kind of thinking?
It always amazes me that when people talk about workers getting an increase, they immediately think the product has to be, the price will it be increased. But they never notice that the CEOs have taken home 360 times what the average worker takes, and they never notice, oh, you know, Mari Barra got, you know, another $28 million. That would not affect the sticker price of my car. I mean, that's ridiculous. The companies are making money hand over fist, and they could afford all of our demands, and not raise the prices. They might have to lower the amount of compensation the CEOs are taking home, but so what?
That wouldn't leave them selling apples on the street corner, would it?
It certainly wouldn't.
No, my goodness. Well, let's move on then with this. A matter of importance to you is that last month there was a conference of socialists in Chicago. I think it was attended by at least 3,000 people, mostly young and mostly women, as I understand it. You attended that conference. What were some of its highlights, especially as they might pertain to the fortunes of working men and women in the U.S. today?
It's interesting that you say it's 3,000. I didn't get a sense that it was 3,000, but that's because most of the conference is in individual workshops.
Yes.
So there's a couple of plenaries, but, you know, not everybody even goes to that. So it certainly was large, and it certainly was diverse, and that was really important. I think it wasn't particularly focused. Yes, there were a few workshops. Workers' rights. So I was very happy that there were four tenant rights workshops and actually a meetup where people could be discussing more specific plans rather than just a workshop. Certainly was different from last year where I think there was just one. But I would say the movements aren't at the stage that they were before the pandemic. And therefore, there's a kind of lack of focus in a conference like this. So hopefully, as the movements get stronger, the workshops and plenaries will be able to reflect that better. I did attend a very important Ukraine Solidarity Network workshop in which we heard from a Russian and two Ukrainian speakers. Which was the beginning of a tour that they were organizing. So there was quite a bit of networking that was going on, but I think the importance of labor, that wasn't the focus of and perhaps couldn't be the focus of that conference at this point in time. Hopefully next conference there'll be more capacity.
Diane, your own socialist organization, which is called Solidarity, what is Solidarity trying to do? And where can our listeners, for that matter, find out more about it and more about your own writings, which are quite extensive?
So we recently had a convention and passed two resolutions, one on consistent anti-imperialism, because we think that there has to be a lot of rethinking about imperialism in this sort of more multipolar moment, and a second resolution on policing and abolition, where we try to point out that the black community, for example, which is more targeted by policing and in the sense of brutality, is nonetheless less secure. So how can we show people that we need to end policing, but nonetheless have security? So that was the sense of that resolution. I would say that in general, our organization, which is a small organization, and you can find it on our website if you type in Solidarity, is involved in a number of social and political struggles. We've been active in caucuses in labor, like UAWD or previous formation Auto Worker Caravan or TDU or any kind of a labor caucus that's fighting for democracy and more power on the shop floor. And we work in larger formations, whether that's in labor or in the environment or active in DSA, and we're very happy to see DSA really take a rank-and-file strategy seriously and work very carefully on the UAW strike. They're out there on the picket line. They're raising money and so forth. So these are the kinds of movements that we want to build, because it's as we develop a broad social movement in which labor can play a key role, socialism can be vibrant. And I'll just say one last thing, and that is I've been very active in reproductive rights since before Roe v. Wade. So I've helped to build a local group here, Michigan Coalition for Reproductive Liberation, and we organized demonstrations last year and fought with other forces to get Proposition 3 on the ballot. So we now have reproductive freedom in the Michigan Constitution. And hopefully Ohio will also get a referendum like that. So right now we're working on trying to get some of the anti-abortion laws that are still on the books taken off the books.
Mm-hmm. And about your own writings, not all of which are on that exact subject, how could people find them as well?
Well, I edit a magazine. I'm one of the editors of a magazine called Against the Current. So they can look that up, againstthecurrent.org. A lot of my articles on reproductive rights or on labor or other issues are there.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Diane Feeley, we thank you so much for your work, but for joining us here today as well on Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much for having me. Hope to see people on the picket line, especially as it expands.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.